Life is chaotic, dangerous, and surprising. Buildings should reflect that. Frank Gehry. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. Still no word from Spotify, so still no theme music. I'm tempted to just upload it with it again, but if I don't hear back soon, I'll be looking for some other new music. And someone asked, why don't you just upload Spotify separately? When I upload on my RSS feed, and that kind of pushes it out to the rest of basically every other platform, essentially. I've got all my accounts linked, so it would just be a whole mess not to do that. So I'm thinking it's just an error in the copyright ID thing. It's probably like an AI thing. It just messed up. Again, they haven't flagged any of my older episodes, but I don't want to risk it, just in case. With that out of the way, we're going to go ahead and start the topic of this week's episode. We will be covering the far northeast of Asia between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever of those you prefer. Before that, though, I did have one thing I forgot to mention last week in regard to the ancestors of modern-day Aboriginal Australians. And it's not really a correction, and I've talked about it before, but I did mean to reiterate and remind my regular listeners, or maybe some newcomers, that the Aboriginal Australians are very genetically diverse, with some of them being less related to each other than Europeans and Asians. So just keep that in mind. So Australia's a big place, even, you know, comparatively. So, you know, I just wanted to remind people of that and put that back out there. Now, much like last week's episode, this episode will also probably be fairly short. The reasons for that are similar to the reasons for last week's length. There isn't much change happening that's showing up in the archaeological record for this time period. There are changes happening, but they're either, you know, going to be progressing slowly, or the full effects of these changes don't become apparent until, you know, future seasons. Or it's a change that's happening during the entire portion of time that this season covers, and it's just something that, you know, the change is happening during the entire period, but it doesn't become apparent until well after the fact. And we'll talk about those changes shortly. But for now, we are going to talk about some of the things that have remained the same from last season in this region. Firstly, let's discuss the people. The name given to the people occupying this area is Paleo-Siberians. This population was made up of two different lineages of people who moved into the area. And we've talked about this before, but just as a reminder or clarification, these were migrants from an early East Asian lineage and ancient Northeast Eurasian. So people who came into Siberia from the west, either up from Central Asia or from like the far reaches of Eastern Europe. And some groups may have, you know, one or two additional lineages, and not like in a huge amount, but maybe like two or so percent, like the Tian Yuan lineage that we talked about in the East Asian episodes. There was also probably some Neanderthal and or Denisovan mixed in a couple of other areas as well. So just keep that in mind too. And these were the cousins of the people who would move into Beringia and the Americas after that. These were the people that stayed behind, and, you know, the Beringians and then the ancestors of the modern Native Americans of both North and South America. That's where they got their first round of ancient North Eurasian and ancient East Asian DNA. Though, we'll talk more about this in later seasons, there is some evidence that possibly they did get other later strains of East Asian DNA, but again, that's kind of speculation, and then there's also just something that happens a little bit later, but again, that's for the future to talk about. But one of the changes that is happening that I mentioned earlier is that during this season, there are more people moving from East Asia and a few from Central Asia, though they don't do it quite as early. They will begin to migrate into the region, and they will leave a lasting impact genetically and linguistically in Siberia, essentially. Now, these migrations are going to start around 6,000 BC in small numbers at first, and then it's going to continue to grow, and then by next season, they will have become the majority of people living in the region, though there are still some groups with more of their ancestry being made up of Paleo-Siberians rather than East Asians or Central Asians, and then there are groups that are primarily descended from these East Asian populations with a little bit of Paleo-Siberian mixed in or Central Asian mixed in, what have you. Now, a few of these groups that still keep, majority Paleo-Siberian ancestry do even hold on to Paleo-Siberian languages even to this day, though there are, of course, declining numbers of those speakers every year. And some have even gone extinct during the historical period. I think around the 1600s, we knew of some that have since gone extinct. Or I guess I should say that they were recorded, at least in European sources, as early as the 1600s. And since then, have gone extinct. And these languages are grouped together into the Paleo-Siberian language family. But it's important to note that this is just a geographic category spread over both the eastern and western ends of Siberia. They are not related to each other linguistically or genetically. And these languages are, I'm going to butcher this, Chukotko-Kamchatkan, Nivik, Yenisean, and Yukagir. The language furthest west in this family, if you want to call it that, is Yenisean, and it is spoken along the Yense River and its tributaries. There were more languages in this family, but right now I believe it's only spoken or still extant language that is part of this family is Ket, and that's only spoken in a very small group in, I think it's the Turhansk district, which is in a part of Russia. I forget the name of the province. But there are not very many speakers of that left. There are only, I think, around 200, I think 150, 200, somewhere around there. Now, interestingly enough, Yenisean is proposed to be part of the Diné Yenisean languages. And for those that don't know, Diné is a very large language family spoken among Native Americans in Alaska, Canada, and I think also parts of the American Southwest. It's got a very large distribution. But you can see, like looking on a map, where the Yenisei River is versus, those places in America. There's a huge gap in between those areas. And I don't think that it's 100% confirmed that the Diné and Yenisean are directly related. That's something I'm going to have to look into. But there are those that think Yenisean languages were, of course, wider spread to the east, and that there are even evidence of Yenisean words in some of the nomads that troubled the Chinese during the dynastic period, even before the Mongols came about. Though that's all, of course, stuff that we will discuss later. But as for the only, again, the only known language that is currently spoken in this is Ket. I think it is also referred to as Imbak as well. Another language in this family is Nivik. It's also called Gilyak or Amurik. And this is also a language isolate. There are only around 1,300 speakers of this. And it is spoken along a portion of the Amur River and the Amgun, which is a tributary of the Amur, and also on the island of Sakhalin in what is now Russia. And there are not very many Nivik people around either. There are only about 5,000 of them, of which about 1,300, as I said, spoke the language. The next language is Yukagir, and this is spoken kind of in the far eastern portion of Russia, not quite up to the coast, though I think there is a little bit of overlap. Today, there are two branches that are still alive. This is Northern Yukagir and Southern Yukagir. We know of two other languages, Amok and Chuvan, but these have since gone extinct recently. And there are only around 516 speakers of both of these. There is the possibility that there have been attempts by a couple of people to tie these into larger language families, kind of as the eastern or western extremes, depending on which theory you go by. There are some that believe it belongs to Uralic, which we've discussed a little bit earlier this season. But then there's also been attempts to tie it in with the Inuit Yupik Unangan languages of North America, also known as Eskalut or Eskimo Aleut. Now that leaves us with the Chukotku-Kamchatkan languages. These are spoken on the, as you might have guessed from the name, the Kamchatkan Peninsula, as well as the stretch of land kind of, you know, bordering Russia's territory to the Arctic and Alaska. These are, I guess, the most widely spoken of the languages. I think there's around 7,000 speakers or so, at least as of 2010. I couldn't find any more recent data. The Kamchatkan branch, it had three branches that we were aware of. Two of those have since died out since they were first categorized. And these are the Etelman, as well as that's the one that is still extant. And then there's Southern and Eastern, which has since gone extinct. And then for the Chukotkin languages, there was Chukchi, Koryak, Aleutor, and Karak is the other that has gone extinct in that family. I should point out that these languages are, some of them are considered to have, you know, their proto-versions from later than this season, but I did want to go ahead and point them out because, you know, these are the people that are most related to the Paleo-Siberians that we're aware of. So I just wanted to kind of put this out there. Their language, of course, is going to develop further because of their contacts with people moving into the region that are bringing new technology, concepts, and things like that. We're going to go into what they're going to be importing later. But for right now, I do want to talk about, the tools and things like that that the Paleo-Siberians are using at this period of time. Before, you know, or right as, you know, these new migrants from East Asia and then Central Asia are going to come in, I'm going to kind of discuss what we know the Paleo-Siberians to have possessed prior to this influx of new peoples. Now, it's important to remember that they're hunter-gatherers. Agricultural does not show up in Siberia until later. I think the earliest I've seen agriculture be proposed to have moved into the region is like 2000 BC, and it is not very widespread for a number of reasons that we'll get into when we talk about the spread of agriculture. Just the environment is not very conducive to it, though there are a couple of places where you can practice agriculture for a brief period of time during the year. So hunting and gathering is the primary mode of living for humans in this region until the Russians begin, you know, moving in or deporting people from the west to the east, you know, in a much later period of time. And I should include fishing in that as well. There are plenty of lakes and rivers and things like that, as well as the sea, that people, you know, are beginning to draw food from as well. Now, by this period, the mammoths are completely gone, or at least on the mainland. We've talked about Wrangel Island before, and a couple of other places, I think, in North America, where they may have been isolated from humans. And who knows, there could have maybe been like a small herd or two that, you know, maybe we haven't discovered yet. But by and large, the large megafauna are completely gone. However, there are still plenty of herd animals for, you know, Paleo-Siberians or peoples from Central Asia or East Asia that are still, you know, in hunter-gatherer mode to hunt. There are things like deer, antelope, horses. There are seals and things like that that can be hunted and were hunted by humans. But with the kind of the loss of the megafauna, you begin to see more and more microlithic blades being adopted by the Siberians on their own, and then more widely adopted as time goes on. Now, if that's just because it's, you know, easier to hunt those type of animals with those types of blades, or if it's something that they just got better at making, or if this is an outside influence, you know, you can debate that several different ways, but microliths were present prior to the season, though they begin to see an increase of use among the Paleo-Siberians. You also begin to see the expansion of pottery being made among the Paleo-Siberians. Now, obviously, this is probably something that came up from East Asia at a much earlier period, but pottery does appear to be becoming more ubiquitous and widespread in the region, even before the East Asians and Central Asians begin to move in. Now, of course, because they're still hunting and gathering, they are following herds still. And I, you know, this is something I probably already should have pointed out. Because they're still mobile hunter-gatherers for the most part, though there is a case of semi-permanent settlements that I'll talk about one specifically here shortly. You know, the Paleo-Siberians are also moving out of this region, though, again, they'll return. But there is evidence of them, or at least some of them, moving into Central Asia, some maybe even as far west as the Ural Mountains. Then you have evidence of them, with some of them, moving into the Americas, following earlier waves of migrations to their cousins. And also, there is speculation, and I think there's been, you know, more and more evidence of this found, that there are, you know, there is evidence of possibly peoples who had gone to, you know, Alaska and that area, you know, maybe within the last couple of thousand years, doing a back migration, reconnecting, you know, at least on some level, with their Paleo-Siberian cousins, and then moving back into the Americas. But we've talked about that a little, but we'll talk about it again as well. So mobility, migration, you know, a much more traditional large scale, you know, migrations are happening among the Paleo-Siberians at this time. It's not just other people moving into their traditional ranges, but they themselves are beginning to spread out. Though, because of the nature of their environment, they maybe haven't been able to increase their populations in Siberia as easily as groups in neighboring regions. Though, when they move out, you know, their skills hold up, as it were, and they are able to establish themselves in areas where they've held on. We've already talked about that with their peoples out along the Yenisei River. But as they were migrating, there were examples of them possibly trying to settle down. There are around 8 or 9 sites that have been found along western Siberia, and I think central Siberia as well. I think there's 1 or 2 there where they appear to be attempting to set up permanent settlements. The oldest of these discovered so far is known as the Amnaya Complex. That's Amnya. This was constructed sometime between 6100 and 6000 BCE. This was a small site composed of around 10 or so pit houses, and it was fortified. They had a wall, they had earthworks of banks and ditches that they had dug into the surrounding area. The site is kind of, it's built kind of along a kind of a steep hill overlooking a nearby river. And I think it's the Ob River. And it was, kind of situated between the river and some peat bogs around it. So that gave them another layer of natural defense as well. They were on the hill kind of overlooking the site. And the houses were not, universally the same. There were different sizes. But all of these houses, or at least a number of them, were burned down and then they were later rebuilt. Most people, at least that have studied this site, believe that this was some type of regular occurrence, or at least semi-regular occurrence, that there was very regular and steady conflict among the Amnaya site and their neighbors. They would also dig out large wooden mounds where things like human skulls and figurines had been buried, making some think that these are either sites of rituals or sacrifice or things like that. The houses were very comfortable. They could be kept very warm. They had central hearths. They were made of wood, and they were very well insulated. They probably didn't have doors, interestingly enough. They probably got in either through holes in the roof or hatches in the roof that they would make, or they used some type of like notched tree or something like that to kind of close up or lock the homes up. And they ranged in size. They did not have like a universal shape or size. They're either square or rectangular. They were all oriented towards the north, and they could be anywhere between 2 to 6 feet deep, which is, I think, 0.5 to 2 meters in depth. And the smallest one was 10 feet by 13 feet. And the largest was 20 by 22 feet, which is like 6 to 6.8 or 9 meters. They vary, very widely in shape. Well, not necessarily in shape, but in size. They found red ochre on the floors of these pit houses. Though the flooring themselves have all degraded, so it was most likely that they were wood. So the red ochre may have been used as something to maybe bless or protect the house from some type of spirit or, evil or what have you. Now, in terms of what else has been found at the site, they've found arrowheads, spears. They have also found pottery, and this is, all appears to be combed wear, kind of roughly made, but you know, in general, you know, the patterning on it is good, and they had a, you know, kind of a wider variety of shapes of bowls. They had some that were flat bottom. They had some that were curved or pointed. They were experimenting with pottery, or at least they were trading for it. They had a lot of different types of stone to choose from to make their tools. They had slate, flint, they had quartz as well. And of course, they also used bone. They found, you know, elk, reindeer, things like that. They were also hunting beavers, probably for fur and maybe meat as well. They were also, with the way their homes were set up, they were in a very good position to smoke or dry meat. And there is also evidence of them, you know, creating fish oil as well. I think they're not 100% sure, because as far as I was able to read, at least in English, there's a lot of Russian that was not able to get translated. But they think that this is some level of, or some type of Paleo-Siberian habitation, at least a few of these sites, because the blades and things like that look a little bit more like the Paleo-Siberian tools, which, you know, earlier periods, there is evidence of migrants from Siberia reaching Central Asia. At least their tools are. Of course, you know, after that, Central Asians begin to, you know, use their own designs. They're inspired by, you know, some tools coming from the Middle East, some coming from Siberia to the northeast, and, you know, places in East and South Asia as well. So there's a lot of give and take in this region. Trade is, you know, it is something that is happening in all directions, even if, you know, Siberia might be a little bit, you know, a little bit more isolated than the rest of Asia. But, again, there are around 8 or 9 of these sites that have been found. And there is evidence of conflict and fighting at all of them. Omnia will be unoccupied around, I think, around the end of the 6000 BC. Well, hold on, let me double check that. So Omnia is occupied for a couple of hundred years, and then it is abandoned. But there is going to be a period of occupation, or reoccupation, right around 4000 BC, and it will continue on there for a little bit longer. I think that's kind of some of the highlights I wanted to go over from Northeast Asia. I think that's kind of a good place to stop. Now, there is still one part of Asia I have not covered yet. That is going to be the area directly to the east of the Ural Mountains. I'm kind of going to group that in with the, you know, with the European side of the Urals as well. I also haven't talked about the coast of the Anatolian Peninsula towards the Aegean, and kind of parts of central Anatolia as well. That is all going to be tied up in the Aegean episode. Or Aegean episodes, most likely. So I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do next. I've got a couple of things I've written out for both, and I guess I want to see like which one would probably be a little bit longer for this upcoming week. But if you guys have any questions, comments, concerns, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You should also comment on my YouTube videos, or you can send me a direct message on X and or Twitter. And I will try to respond there as soon as I can. I appreciate you guys for stopping by this week. I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. And please like, favorite, subscribe, download, rate 5 stars, whatever your platform asks you to do, support, you know, whatever creator you like, please do so on the episode and on the show in general. I will see everyone next week, I hope, and I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you hear this one. I'll see everyone next time. Excuse me. Peace.